Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a book that will make you angry, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with the author's viewpoint. My guest today is James B. Steele, currently an investigative reporter for Vanity Fair. He and his reporting partner, Donald Bartlett, have worked at Time Magazine, Philadelphia Inquirer, where they've had an enduring interest in the status of the middle class. In the meantime, they've also picked up two Pulitzer Prizes for newspaper reporting and two National Magazine Awards for magazine work. They are the authors of seven books, including their 1992 controversial bestseller, America, What Went Wrong, about Washington's assault on the middle class. Their latest book, The Betrayal of the American Dream, follows up on that effort. They state baldly that American government and business have betrayed the middle class. In the book, they look at the adverse effects of outsourcing. They illuminate unfair and unequal trading practices of our trading partners across the world that prove that what we consider free trade is far from fair trade. They show how deregulation, rather than opening up the marketplace to more players, has actually resulted in the consolidation and contraction of many large industries, reducing jobs and driving down wages. They also speak the truth about taxes, that the wealthy do not pay their fair share compared to historical standards, that many multinational corporations are knowingly parking millions of dollars in profits offshore to avoid paying taxes here in the U.S. In fact, they say that our entire democracy is on the verge, or perhaps has already become, a plutocracy. The name of the book is The Betrayal of the American Dream. James B. Steele is my guest today. Jim Steele, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Great to be with you, Rich.
In this book, your latest with your reporting partner, Donald Bartlett, The Betrayal of the American Dream, you boldly refer to our current state of affairs by what I would call the P word, plutocracy, which a lot of people shy away from. Even when somebody invokes class warfare, you see a vehement reaction. I would think to the word plutocracy, you would see even a bigger reaction.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, Rich, because we do use that word in the book, but we use it really as a quote from basically it was a Citigroup financial analyst who used a variation of this in describing what the United States has become. He talked about what the markets are out there, who businesses want to appeal to. And one of the things that was really scary for us is that the financial elite in this country, whether they're a plutocracy or a financial aristocracy, whatever you want to call them, they have written off the American middle class. And this is what's so scary to us. And we've actually got quotes in the book to this effect. One was from a hedge fund guy who told one journalist, he said, if we're able to lift people into the middle class in China and India, where there are a lot more folks, and we lose, you know, some in the middle class in America, that's a pretty good trade-off. Well, you know, that kind of raised hair on the back of our necks, because that's not actually what the message that a lot of American middle class people think folks who run this country or try to run this country should be delivering. But I think people increasingly realize that the economic elite in this country, the financial aristocracy, do not have their best interests at heart. They're assisting with the whole offshoring of jobs because that means more money for their stockholders. It means more money, executive salaries for the folks who run those companies. But it means less for millions of people in this country. I mean, we're always going to have a middle class. But folks in the middle are being squeezed today like never before. And it's not just unemployment. That's the point about the book. Unemployment's terrible, and most of the numbers are underestimated as to how bad it is. But most of the people we write about in the book, I mean, they're in fact employed, but they're very often earning two-thirds of what they earned 3 or 4 years ago, or half what they earned, because there's been this inexorable downward pressure on earnings, benefits, and all of those resources that middle-class Americans have used to help themselves and provide for their families.
And I was going to say, even if they're still working in the job they've been working in for most of their career, you know, their salaries are oftentimes flatlined, and then they lose progress that way. And in a lot of companies, it's been a, you know, if you have your job, it's been a series of givebacks over the last decade.
That's exactly right. And that's why, you know, the book isn't just about the unemployed. I mean, if you don't have a job, that's the worst, of course. But what we're seeing across the middle class is exactly the way you described it. It's a stagnation of wages, salaries. And then on top of that, people very often are having some of their benefits taken away from them, or things they thought they were going to have, like their 401k plans, have never come back since the great downturn of several years ago. So all of these things that were supposed to be kind of the underpinning of a good, solid middle-class life, either being taken away or systematically eroded.
Now, when you compare the U.S. economy to other developed economies, it almost sounds like the United States has really just sort of bought into this whole idea of a trans-global economy. And so it really doesn't matter where the jobs created, where the jobs are lost. I would think most other developed economies, if not protectionist in a lot of industries, at least try to have some protectors for their key industries. Do we have any of those protections?
You're absolutely right about other countries, and generally speaking here, we do not have those, and that's been our policy. We have been the great free traders of the world, and Don and I make the point in the book, there's nothing wrong with free trade. It's a wonderful idea if it's practiced properly, but we've practiced in this country kind of an unrestricted free trade, so that we've let our doors open to products from around the globe, which has also enabled a lot of our own companies to shift their operations abroad and bring those goods back without any duties or taxes. Other countries, other developed countries, particularly certainly the Asian countries, I don't just mean China as a development country, but even Japan, Singapore, Malaysia, Western Europe, all of those countries have taken a much more restrictive view toward free trade. They're capitalist economies, they believe in free trade, but they also believe that there's an important point to be made to make sure some of your fundamental domestic industries are not wiped out, especially by unfair trade practices. And the thing people tell us the most about the book that has surprised them the most is the description of free trade. Many people have said, well, I've always been a complete believer in free trade. I thought it was the greatest thing in the world, but I've read your book and I realize it's just not working in this country anymore. And it isn't working because we have this blind view of it. And we need to be a little bit tougher in terms of making sure other markets are open to our goods, and when they're not, to take steps to enforce that. I mean, critics of this will always say, well, gosh, we can't build walls around the United States. We'll have a trade war. Things will be horrible. It's not an either-or situation. It's not a matter of building walls around the country, but it's a matter of making sure that others play by the same rules we do. And we've never had the gumption, we've never had the backbone, and doesn't make any difference whether it's a Republican or Democratic administration. I mean, both parties, both folks in charge of the White House over the years have been guilty of this.
And in fact, you write that the trading entities, other countries know this. They know that we don't have the gumption, so they feel free to erect any barriers they feel that they need to do for their own internal economy, because their reaction is, the U.S. will squawk about it, but they won't do anything about it.
Yeah, that is exactly right, and that is exactly the point we make in the book. And one of the best examples of this is Japan. I mean, the U.S. has negotiated, I don't know how many agreements with Japan for access to their markets, particularly in an area of auto parts. I mean, these go back years and years, and the Japanese always smile and they sign these agreements, but then nothing changes, and we complain. But again, we do not take any kinds of forceful steps that might force them to change their ways. And because we won't do that, and because any time anything like that's even suggested, the free traders in this country sort of go crazy and say, we can't do that, that we'll set off a trade war. Because of that, nothing ever changes. And as a result of that, we are now approaching $10 trillion in cumulative trade deficits since the mid-70s. And one point I should make, the trade deficit isn't just this abstract figure out there that shows up in the economic statistics. It has to do with jobs. And when your exports and your imports are in some kind of balance with each other, that's a very healthy aspect of your economy. It means you are exporting, but you're also importing certain things. But in this country, where we once had that up until the mid-70s, it's just every year, year after year, the balance gets further and further out of kilter. And as a result of that, the number of jobs we lose through imports vastly overwhelms the number of jobs that are created by exports.
And I love the fact that you bring this up in the book, this that, you know, politicians love to talk about the fact that exports create jobs. And anytime there's an export opportunity, they're saying, this is going to create so many jobs. But when they talk about, well, if export creates jobs, you say, well, then imports must destroy jobs.
Right, exactly. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist, you're right, to figure out the other half of it. But none of the quotes out of the politicians ever deal with that. All they do is extol. And again, this is both parties over the years. They just extol the value of exports. One of the points we make in the book, the largest bulk export, not dollar amount, but just in terms of the most containers leaving American ports,
yes,
is now waste paper, old used cardboard. And particularly the ports of Long Beach in L.A., all this cardboard is loaded into these empty containers. It's then shipped over to China, where it's reprocessed into cardboard boxes, which then package the toys, the electronics, and other goods that the Chinese are making, but then they're shipped back to this market. That in bulk is our single largest export. And nothing showed us, you know, how things are cockeyed in this country any more than that statistic.
And of course, if you expand that to other areas, semiconductors, used semiconductors often go to China the same way.
Absolutely.
To be recycled and, you know, to create environmental quagmires in certain places of China. You know, where do you think all of our old style TV sets are going?
That's right, exactly.
Maybe not to China, but somewhere else to be recycled. Yeah,
that's exactly right. And
these are counted as exports, aren't they?
They are counted as exports, and not only is cardboard a big export, waste paper, but scrap metal. I mean, which is part of that whole process. I mean, those are some of our biggest exports. I mean, you look at these numbers cold as we did, and I thought, you think, what is the United States anymore? Are we a third world country on something like this? And on that area, we are. I mean, and here's what's so scary to us. Our largest dollar volume export, where we really do have a surplus, is civilian aviation aircraft, but mainly Boeing. And this turned out to be one of the most disturbing stories of all for us, because in order to gain entry into the Chinese market, Boeing has been systematically opening plants in China or forming joint ventures with various Chinese companies to build parts and sections of various civilian aircraft. But on top of that, what Boeing is now doing, and the Chinese are insisting upon this, and by the way, this is not just Boeing. Other companies in other industries, unfortunately, are doing the same thing. The Chinese are insisting that they want to know the technical know-how. So Boeing is basically sharing with the Chinese their manual on how to build a civilian jet plane. And that what have the Chinese done? They have announced the formation through their government of a company that will build civilian aircraft that will compete with Boeing. And I mean, and this gets back again to this, what we were talking about on free trade. Here you have a case where another government, the Chinese Communist government, has founded a company, has put money into it, and has declared that this is a national priority. They're going to create a company, a corporation, that will build airplanes that will compete with Boeing. And Boeing is assisting this. And when you consider the fact that a lot of Boeing's know-how comes from U.S. federal taxpayer dollars and defense contracts, I mean, what is this down the road? If this is our main export, civilian aircraft, how long are we going to have that?
Yeah. In fact, the whole story about Boeing was really sad, because they have moved so many jobs overseas to build the Dreamliner to gain access to markets like China. And, you know, it would be one thing if the system worked great, but in fact, when they moved these jobs overseas, they had shoddy, you know, quality control. And as a result, that airliner has been, what, how many billion dollars over budget and behind schedule? That's
exactly.
Another sad thing. It's like, I could see it if it was, you know, I wouldn't approve of it, but I could see it if it was sheer efficiency. But it's, no, this is just about money and not efficiencies. Apparently, a lot of these outsourced suppliers were not capable, at least at first, of doing the quality work that Boeing needed.
That's absolutely right. And I'm glad you mentioned the word efficiency, because that is the basis, sort of the philosophical, economic basis for doing all of this. It's more efficient to have folks that make less money or whatever incentives another country provides. Down the line, it's a lower cost. But you're so right in the case of Boeing. And one of the problems Boeing ran into there was not just the shoddy workmanship, but the fact that they had difficulty coordinating all of these various components that were coming into the Dreamliner, which is their new big dramatic long-range aircraft, because it was coming in from so many different sources. You go back 30 or 40 years, and you look at something like the 747, some of those famous Boeing planes that were created many years ago. Those are overwhelmingly built in this country, and the suppliers were overwhelmingly in this country. So now Boeing's got this crazy global network, half the time of which it doesn't even work. And the other thing about that, we saw this same kind of problem with the building of the Bay Bridge in San Francisco Bay, because the Chinese came in competing with an American consortium that wanted to provide the steel to rebuild the bridge. And they came in way under the budget of the American companies. But as it turned out, after this was awarded to the Chinese steel company outside of Shanghai, problems began to develop with the welds in the steel. So California Department of Transportation actually had to send hundreds of engineers and auditors over there to live in China for a while to monitor the quality of this work. There were other problems that arose that led to change orders. Nobody to this day knows what the total cost of the steel in that Bay Bridge is, but we would not be surprised that it ultimately came in about the same of what the American consortium bid, because they knew what some of the problems might be. The Chinese repeatedly bid low, get a job, and then proceed to engage in change orders that run up the cost. So not only have we lost jobs in this country, but it hasn't been an efficient way to even run our economy.
My guest today is James B. Steele, investigative reporter, along with his reporting partner, Donald L. Bartlett. They have written for major American newspapers, news magazines, now with Vanity Fair, have won two Pulitzer Prizes for their work. Their latest book is titled The Betrayal of the American Dream, which they sort of line up the cost of globalization, of how tax policy has changed, and concluded that we're, if not already in a plutocracy, we're getting there. And I want to talk about Citizens United for a moment. That decision, in many cases, this was maybe one of the last pieces of the puzzle, because at least you had, you know, that case provided some limits on the rich and powerful participate in elections. Now, certainly there's always been ways around it, but this really drops a lot of the barriers, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this really opened the gates to even more and more money coming from fewer and fewer people with all kinds of resources. And I think it has people very, very concerned because, I mean, the heart of a democracy is as many people as possible participating in it. Most people are not going to have the kind of money to be financing election campaigns. They may be able to send in their $5, $10, $20 to their candidate, but they're not going to have at their disposal millions and millions of dollars right out of their personal bank accounts.
And if I may stop you for a second, I mean, the lobbying process is something that most ordinary people can't participate in. The idea that once you have your representative, that lobbying process is going to affect them. Most ordinary people can't participate in that. But in the election process, this is, you know, who you choose to be that representative who's going to face that pressure. You know, exactly. That's the one remaining sort of barrier.
That's right. And maybe it didn't always work perfectly, and sometimes it didn't work at all, but there was at least the possibility that it might work that way. But once you've dropped all of these restrictions and now the money can go in, it's going to lead the way to who knows what. An example of this, I know the Koch brothers of Wichita, the second wealthiest individuals really in the country, have announced that a couple of foundations they're involved with have disclosed that they are going to pump money into some of the key states in terms of advertising to try to influence those elections. And one of them is Pennsylvania, which is a swing state, and they're going to attack President Obama on the basis of a deficit. Well, the Koch brothers have saved who knows how many millions of dollars because of tax breaks just the last 10 years that have reduced the taxes on the dividends that they can pay themselves. So basically, with free money, they're saving from their tax cuts they're not going to use that to pump into advertising, millions of dollars in advertising, to influence people saying President Obama is responsible for the deficit. Look, you may not like President Obama, maybe some things you disagree with him, but he's not responsible for this deficit these last 4 years. He inherited a situation. You had an economic implosion, which means when the economy went south, which means you're going to collect less in tax money. That's going to increase the deficit. And the one thing he tried to do, his modest stimulus plan, we probably needed to do more, not less during this time. And even that turned out to be very controversial. So, like I say, you may not like the man, you may not like him, but don't blame him for this deficit. And yet here will be this advertising, perfect example of the kind of free flow of money into the campaigns, like on a scale never seen before, that will probably influence unwittingly a lot of people in the wrong way.
My guest today is James B. Steele, investigative reporter, currently with Vanity Fair. He and his reporting partner, Donald Bartlett, have won numerous awards for their investigative reporting, and their latest book is titled The Betrayal of the American Dream. Well, you talked about taxes, and that whole section on taxes in the book begins with a very, very simple statistic. In 1955, the 400 richest Americans paid about 51% of their income in taxes. In 2007, the same 400 richest Americans paid 16.6% of their income in federal taxes, I should say. But that is a huge change. And in the book, you relate what that 50% of taxes paid for. It brought us the GI Bill, veterans benefits, first-time higher education federal loans for college. It gave us the interstate highway system, important infrastructure. And while those systems still continue, there's no similar sort of development of developing the middle class in 2007 at that 16.6% rate.
That's absolutely right. And one of the things that really struck us, it's a kind of a parallel statistic to the one you mentioned, was when you look at the 1950s, 60s, and 70s, the rate of personal income growth by folks in the middle class and the very wealthy in this country, basically the rate grew at roughly the same rate. So in other words, kind of all boats really were sort of rising in that sense, except for the very, very poor, but certainly in the middle class and the very wealthy. But from the late 70s, especially from the 80s on, this began to diverge. And the reason a lot of it diverged was because of a systematic number of tax cuts that began to be applied from really 1980 on, and particularly in the last decade. All of that is tremendously contributed to inequality and left less money in the coffers. I mean, the tax cuts just in the last 10 years, one estimate out there is that they have contributed $700 billion to the deficit. So the idea that the deficit is just solely because of spending, it is also because there's less money coming into it.
I mean, one of the things you tackle is explaining the carried interest tax break. This is the tax break that allows a lot of the very super rich to pay income taxes at that lowest 15% rate, Warren Buffett's secretary's rate, or
yes.
Or certain political figures, secretaries.
Well, we would all love this one, of course. I mean, nobody is ever happy about taxes, but the carried interest rate is one available to these fellows who run the private equity companies in this country. Like, certainly Mitt Romney in the past when he was with Bain, I suspect he's still deriving benefits from that because of his ongoing revenue stream from there. But what it is, most of us, we have a job. We pay income taxes based on whatever the rate of our income is, whether it's 15 or 25% or above. But the folks that run these private equity companies, part of their salary is taxed at the high rate. But another part of it is this thing called carried interest, where they have taken a piece of one of the companies they do a deal on, and they call that a capital gain. But in fact, it's this term called carried interest. But in fact, all it is another form of their salary that lets them reduce their tax bill substantially. I mean, this would be the same thing if you had an excellent biochemist there at the University of Tulsa, let's say, who was making $150,000, and some part of his salary is taxed at 35% to tail end. Under this system, a substantial part of his income would be taxed at 15%. Yeah. You know, it's just the kind of thing that is not available to the average person. It's legal under what's going on out there in this world, but it's a classic gimmick that's available to those folks in private equity. And the amazing thing is, about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, there was a movement to try to roll that back, to just make that money taxable like any other salary. But the private equity industry rose up. They hired some very smooth lobbyists. They pumped their money into Washington. Folks like Henry Kravis came in, paid visits to senators and congressmen about what a terrible thing this would be if they lost that benefit, and the thing went nowhere. So and that was a Congress even more inclined to change the tax code than the one that's in there now. So it's another illustration how the folks with money are able to get their way in Washington, and it's a tremendous frustration to anybody who pays taxes at the proper rate.
Well, one of your recommendations is to raise tax rates, but it's also to change the fact that a dividend dollar looks just like a salary dollar, and perhaps right. They should all be taxed at the same level. Everything, and you know, whether it's a carried interest dollar or dividend, a capital gains dollar, or a salary dollar.
Absolutely, and what's interesting about this, this isn't some radical suggestion. I mean, that's the way dividend income used to be taxed. In fact, there was a period of time in this country where dividend income was taxed at a higher rate than salaries. So what we're talking about is not some revolutionary idea. We're just saying we need to turn the clock back a little bit to the system that once worked so much better in this country than what we have now, which is funneling tremendous amounts of money to fewer and fewer people. We need to change that. And to do that is merely adopting rates that we had in the past. Most of the folks who talk about simplicity in the tax code, they say the problem is we got too many rates. That's not true. The multiple rates do not create the confusion in the tax code. Whether you have 2 rates or 10 rates, it's beside the point. But if you have multiple rates, you're going to have a fairer system. I mean, what is the justification for somebody making $350,000? I know that's a lot of money, but for that tail end of their income there, what is the justification for them paying taxes on that income the same as somebody making $10 million? But that's the way it is nowadays. Mm-hmm. That's not the way it used to be. There used to be a series of rates where the more you made, the more you were taxed. But only the very highest rates affected those making $10 million, $15 million, $20 million, so forth in a year's time.
Well, the name of the book is The Betrayal of the American Dream. My guest today, along with his writing partner, Donald L. Bartner, is James B. Steele. Jim, thanks very much for joining us today.
Rich, my pleasure.
James B. Steele is the co-author, along with Donald Bartlett, of The Betrayal of the American Dream. It's published by Public Affairs. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.